Thank you for joining me. I'm Kimberly Rogers, and you're listening to the Torah portion for September 9th and 10th, 2011, from sundown to sundown. This Torah portion is brought to you by The Messianic Message. I hope that you enjoy this teaching. Ki tetze, when you go out, is what those two words mean. It is Deuteronomy chapter 21, starting in verse 10, to chapter 25, verse 19. The Haftarah is Isaiah 54, verses 1 to 10, and the Brit Hadashah is Matthew 5, verses 27 to 30, and 1 Corinthians 5, verses 1 to 5. Ki tetze means when you go out, and I call this a practical Torah portion. In fact, I call it the dilemma Torah portion. It has to do with all of those things that are of a practical nature, all of the places where human beings can bump up against each other and against nature, and just various things. There are just so many topics covered in this Torah portion. That really what it has to do with is the outward things, the things that we do, not necessarily the things of the heart and the mind, like we've seen in the earlier Torah portions, you know, the things of mercy and justice and those things. This has to do with just the real practical matters of everyday life. And the first thing that this Torah portion deals with in Deuteronomy 21:10 is war brides. When you go out to war against your enemies and the Lord your God gives them into your hand and you take them captive, and you see among the captives a beautiful woman and you desire to take her to be your wife, and you bring her to your house, she shall shave her head and pare her nails, and she shall take off the clothes in which she was captured, and shall remain in your house and lament her father and her mother a full month. After that you may go into her and be her husband, and she shall be your wife. But if you no longer delight in her, you shall let her go where she wants, but you shall not sell her for money, nor shall you treat her as a slave, since you have humiliated her. You see, we know a lot about war brides in America, but war brides in America are generally women that have been met and courted by men that are overseas fighting, and so they're not brides that are being rounded up and tied to ropes and being, you know, led along in order to come from their land to Israel. No, they are a totally different kind of war bride. What this is talking about is the woman that gets noticed by the warrior. Now, this warrior is a single man. He does not have a family back in Israel. And for whatever reason, that he has not been able to find a wife among his own people, the Lord says, if you find a woman who has attracted your attention, you know, during a battle or after the battle is over, you can take her back to your house. And the Lord gives them 30 days to deal with what's going on with each of them. For instance, you know, he gets 30 days to cool off, and she gets 30 days to mourn and lament her father and mother. It's interesting that right here is where we actually have what God says is the definition of marriage. That he goes into her. What does that mean? He goes in and has sex with her. And then he is her husband. But only if it pleases him to do so after the 30 days. You know, he can't go in and have sex with her and then say, well, he doesn't like her. See, verse 14 doesn't mean that he gets to go in and have sex with her and then, you know, say that he doesn't like her anymore. No. That means before he goes in to have sex with her, if he has cooled off and decides that, you know, she's no longer the beautiful woman that he thought she was, then that means he's not delighting in her. He's not to go in and take her that way. He shall let her go, and she shall go wherever she wants to go, and he can't sell her for money. He can't say, well, I had her in my house for 30 days, and I fed her, and now, so now I need to sell her and get money. No, no. He needs to not treat her as a slave, because having her in his house and then deciding not to marry her is humiliation for her. So it doesn't mean here that the man can just, you know, have a sex slave, and then when he's done with her, he can just let her go wherever she wants. That is the improper interpretation of this scripture. No man gets to treat any woman that way. It doesn't matter whether she is a stranger from a foreign land that he has captured and brought into his house, or if she is a woman from among his own people. Men are to treat women with respect. Then we come to Deuteronomy 21, verse 15. If a man has two wives, the one loved and the other unloved, and both the loved and the unloved have borne him children, and if the firstborn son belongs to the unloved, then on the day when he assigns his possessions as an inheritance to his sons, he may not treat the son of the loved as the firstborn in preference to the son of the unloved, who is the firstborn. But he shall acknowledge the firstborn, the son of the unloved, by giving him a double portion of all that he has, for he is the firstfruits of his strength. The right of the firstborn is his. You see, the right of the firstborn can be taken away because of their sins. We saw this with Reuben, Simeon, and Levi. But the right of the firstborn cannot be taken away because of the sins of the parents, because one wife is loved and the other wife is not. You know, if you have a son with a woman and then you divorce that woman and now you're remarried, well, obviously you love the second wife more than you love the first wife. But you can't say because you love the wife, the second wife, that one gets the firstborn blessing. It doesn't work that way. Now, think about Leah and Rachel. One was loved and the other was unloved, right? And again, Reuben, Simeon, and Levi all lost their right to inherit the firstborn blessing because of their sins, and that made Judah receive it. Now, Joseph is the firstborn of Rachel, whom Jacob loved, but he is not the firstborn of the brethren. You know, there are a lot of people that are going around saying that they believe that Joseph is somehow going to get a special firstborn blessing. No, that's not going to happen. Judah is the firstborn, and he's always going to be the firstborn. But you see, the firstborn gets a double portion. We find that right here in verse 17. Why does a firstborn get a double portion? Is it so that, you know, he can be richer than all of his brethren and that gives him status as the firstborn? No, that double portion is not a status thing. That double portion is part of the firstborn's special duty toward his brethren. The firstborn gets a double portion because they have a duty to help their brethren, to redeem their brethren. This is, you see, Yeshua is the firstborn. He is the redeemer. He gets the double portion, so he redeems the brethren because of his responsibility as the firstborn. You see, the firstborn, that's his job to do with that double portion, is to redeem his brethren. So, Over the centuries, people have noted that the Jews prosper wherever they go and whatever they do. Well, it's a mandate by God for this to be so. Now, that does not mean that I'm saying all Jews are wealthy. What I am saying is, as a nation, they do better than other nations, even when they're scattered in the world to the four winds. It's because they have this double portion, and it is their duty to help redeem their 11 other brothers. Now let's talk about rebellious children. Verse 18, if a man has a stubborn and rebellious son who will not obey the voice of his father or the voice of his mother, and though they discipline him will not listen to them, then his father and his mother will take hold of him and bring him out to the elders of the city at the gate of the place where he lives, and they shall say to the elders of this city, our son is stubborn and rebellious. He will not obey our voice. He is a glutton and a drunkard. Then all the men of the city shall stone him to death with stones. So you shall purge the evil from your midst, and all Israel shall hear and fear. You know, the teaching here is that this is actually preventive medicine. That the rabbis say that there's no record of ever any parents bringing their children to the gates and having them stoned because the child is a glutton and a drunkard. A glutton, well, we can understand that the way children eat, but what, a drunkard? A child, a drunkard? No, you see the incongruity there? Yeah, a child could be a glutton. He could also, be growing and just eating a lot. But a child being a drunkard? No. So there's this incongruity here in this part of the Torah portion that makes people think that this is preventive medicine that is provided by the Lord as a kind of last-ditch effort to get your child to obey. What I mean by that is that the parents can say to the rebellious son, if you don't stop being rebellious, we're going to take you to the gates of the city, to the elders, and they're going to stone you to death. However, it doesn't say very much about the parents that they have a child like that. Why? Because rebellious children most often are rebellious because there's a bad marriage. The parents don't work together and discipline the child together and agree upon how the child is supposed to be raised, and so the child ends up being able to play one parent against the other, and because he can do that and get away with it, he becomes more and more rebellious. So it's not actually the child's fault. It's the parents' fault. And I think this is probably the biggest reason why no parents have ever taken their son or daughter to the gates of the city and said to the elders, this child is stubborn and rebellious. He's a glutton and a drunkard. I think that that's because they don't want to indict themselves in their community as being bad parents. Now, the other thing is, not only is it preventive medicine, and not only does it speak about the marriage between the parents, but this would be just about impossible to hold up. Because by the time that you get a rebellious child from a bad marriage and go over to the gates, you're going to have a dispute between the parents, and you're not going to have the two witnesses needed. You see, the two parents have to come together, two witnesses. So you're not going to have that kind of agreement between both parents that something needs to be done with this child, namely, he needs to be killed. So here you have three reasons why this passage sticks out as kind of an anomaly, and is used by those who despise the Torah to teach that the Torah is harsh. It's because they don't understand anything else in Torah. They don't understand about the two witnesses, and they don't understand the incongruity of a child being a drunkard. You know, they don't take a look at what kind of relationship the parents had and the responsibility that the parents would have in this case, and the fact that they would always probably be ostracized from their community. No, they just use this as their excuse to say that the Torah is harsh. Well, actually, right here, this is probably one of the most merciful commandments in the Torah, especially if it's viewed as preventive measures instead of punitive measures, because it makes everybody stand back and think twice, not only the parents, but the child. Verse 22, and if a man has committed a crime punishable by death, and he is put to death, and you hang him on a tree, his body shall not remain all night on the tree, but you shall bury him the same day, for a hanged man is cursed by God. You shall not defile your land that the Lord your God is giving you for an inheritance. Well, you know, we in the Hebrew Roots movement understand this as pertaining also to the Messiah, because if you're hanged on a tree, that means then you are cursed by God. But this Torah section here says that if a man has committed a crime punishable by death. You see, Yeshua didn't commit any crimes punishable by death, yet he was put to death and he was hung on a tree, and therefore he was at that time cursed by God for our sakes, according to the Torah, because it was us who committed the crimes that are punishable by death. But Yeshua hung on that tree for us so that we would not have to suffer that curse. Now, the other thing about people hanging in trees is that people hanging there indefinitely pollute the whole area around where they are. Those bodies become food for predators. And so, not only is there this pollution, but they're food for predators, and this shows great lack of respect for the one who died along with his family. You see, even in death, even if somebody has committed a crime, there is a certain amount of protocol and respect that goes along with taking care of his body. It shows respect not only for him as a human being, but also for his family. Chapter 22, verse 1. You shall not see your brother's ox or his sheep going astray and ignore them. You shall take them back to your brother. And if he does not live near you and you do not know who he is, you shall bring it to your house and it shall stay with you until your brother seeks it. Then you shall restore it to him. And you shall do the same with his donkey or with his garment or with any lost thing of your brother's which he loses and you find. You may not ignore it. You shall not see your brother's donkey or his ox fallen down by the way and ignore them. You shall lift him, or you shall help him to lift them up again. Again, it's a matter of respect. You know, you run into these dilemmas. You find something that somebody owns and you don't know who it belongs to, so what's the thing to do? The dilemma is what to do. Keep it or find the owner? Well, you go find the owner. You let other people know that you have this donkey or this wallet or this garment that belongs to somebody else. And you see if you can't get the owner to come and get this thing from you. And if you can't, you hang on to it until at some point in the future he does come and get it. It's just a matter of respect. In fact, That's what ki tetse is actually about. It's the outward things that you do, that people see you do, that show that you have respect for other people. Now, here's one that we don't normally think about having to do with respect. It says, a woman shall not wear a man's garment, nor shall a man put on a woman's garment, for whoever does these things is an abomination to the Lord your God. Well, we know that this has to do with cross-dressing and homosexuality and that, but it's disrespectful for a woman to act like a man, and it's disrespectful for a man to act like a woman. That's ultimately, if you extrapolate this out, you come to this conclusion that it has to do with respecting your own station in life and not usurping what is not yours. It's a matter of respect. Deuteronomy 22:6. If you come across a bird's nest in any tree or on the ground with the young ones or eggs, and the mother sitting on the young ones or on the eggs, you shall not take the mother with the young. You shall let the mother go, but the young you may take for yourself, that it may go well with you and that you may live long. This has to do again with mercy, and this is the what they call the least of the commandments. This is the mercy and justice that you show to a mother bird and her eggs. And Yeshua said that God takes care of the sparrows, so how much more will he take care of his children? Well, that's what we have here in this commandment, this least commandment. We're supposed to show that much mercy to a bird. How much more respect and mercy then are we to show to each other? You see, again, going back to Shoftim last week when I said these are the weightier matters. This is a weighty matter here. We can do all of the outward things, but if we don't have the mercy and the respect that's needed towards others, we have neglected the weightier matters. Now I'm going to skip down to verse number 10, and it says that you shall not plow with an ox and a donkey together. This is not just about plowing a field with two different animals. It's not just about what it says in verse 9 about mixing things together. We understand that there's a spiritual truth underneath verse 10, and it is that you're not to unequally yoke things. You're not to unequally yoke animals, and we, people, believers, are not to be unequally yoked. The ox is a clean animal, the donkey is an unclean animal. You have Hebrews and Gentiles, clean and unclean. Hebrews and Gentiles are not to be yoked. Now, why? Why does God say to two people, don't be unequally yoked? I mean, after all, if you have a believer, a Hebrew, and you have a Gentile, isn't it going to be that the Hebrew will lead the Gentile? Well, of course, we know that generally things spiral downward, right? Clean becomes unclean much easier than unclean becomes clean. But generally, that's what people would think. Well, I'll just marry this Gentile because I can get that Gentile converted, and that Gentile will come to the assembly with me and will begin to love the Lord like I do. And no, that's not the way that it works. So there is a reason for us not to be unequally yoked, as it says in 1 Corinthians 6:14. It's because, like those two different animals, two different people will pull their weight differently. They will have different temperaments, different ideas. They will always be pulling against each other. And they're not even able to pull the same amount of weight. Actually, yoking two unequal things to each other is unjust for both of those things. To yoke an ox and a donkey together is unjust to both the ox and the donkey. The ox and the donkey cannot understand each other. The donkey will be pulling, 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 pulling. The ox will be just kind of walking along, chewing its cud, and the donkey's going to be going, "What are you doing?" And the ox is going to be saying, "I'm working," and the donkey's little legs are going to be running faster. You see how that works, right? Well, that spiritual principle applies to a Hebrew and a Gentile that are yoked together. They're not going to understand each other's ways. They're going to always be at odds with each other. And this is why the Bible says, do not be unequally yoked in 2 Corinthians 6:14. Now, we're going to skip all of those laws concerning sexual relations, just as a matter of, for time, the sake of time. We're going to go down to verse 1 of chapter 23. It says, "No one whose testicles are crushed or whose male organ is cut off shall enter the assembly of the Lord." Now, we're going to take that and go down here to where it says 25:11, "When men fight with one another and the wife of the one draws near to rescue her husband from the hand of him who is beating him and puts out her hand and seizes him by the private parts, then you shall cut off her hand. Her eye shall have no pity." Why? Because she is now going to prevent him from being able to enter the tabernacle. There is no fight between two men that should ever cause one of them to not be able to enter the tabernacle. That's why you shall not cause someone to not be able to go into the tabernacle. Now, when we're going to go back up to 24, verse 1. "When a man takes a wife and marries her, if then she finds no favor in his eyes because he has found some indecency in her, and he writes her a certificate of divorce and puts it in her hand and sends her out of the house, and she departs out of his house, and if she goes and becomes another man's wife, and the latter man hates her and writes her a certificate of divorce and puts it in her hand and sends her out of his house, or if the latter man dies who took her to be his wife, then her former husband who sent her away may not take her again to be his wife after she has been defiled, for it is an abomination before the Lord, and you shall not bring sin upon the land that the Lord your God is giving you for an inheritance." You see, this right here describes why people are not allowed to remarry after they have been divorced and married to someone else. And it also is the reason why Yeshua had to die, or it's actually one of the reasons why Yeshua had to die, because Israel had taken another husband. Israel had committed adultery with Baal, another husband, and so Yeshua divorced her, and now he cannot take her back. Well, we've already seen that the definition of marriage is when the man goes into the woman and they have sex. That's the definition of marriage, which is why it is so bad that we have so much promiscuity going on that has gone on for centuries, but most recently from the 60s with that, you know, that yuppie flower power hippy dippy mess that my generation came through, and looking back on it just makes my stomach turn. They don't understand that every time they had sex with somebody, they were marrying that person. And I know people right now don't want to believe that definition of marriage. They want to think that marriage has to do with you getting a piece of paper. Or, if not getting a piece of paper, that you have to have, you know, two witnesses, and, you know, we married each other in private and there's no witnesses, and so we weren't really married, you know, for all those years when we had children and all that stuff that happened. And when we got divorced and we both had other spouses, and now those spouses are out of our lives for whatever reason, and now we want to get back together. Oh, no, we weren't really married. We didn't have a piece of paper and we didn't have any witnesses. We just had sex. But that wasn't really being married. Well, I'm sorry. It is being married. But there is more to this right here for this end time generation. Now, you know that the book of Revelation is written to the bond servants. It is not written to unbelievers. It's written to people who believe in God, who believe in Yeshua. Now, some of them call him Jesus, but this applies to them even if they're not keeping the commandments, because, you know, they're supposed to be keeping the commandments. So what does this Deuteronomy 24, 1 to 4, have to do with anything in the tribulation? Well, it has to do with the mark of the beast. Because you see, believers who decide that they are going to take the mark of the beast in order for them to live, those people who do not understand the commandments, who refuse and reject the commandments even though they know better, those people who take the mark of the beast are going to be taking another husband. This is why someone who takes the mark can never be forgiven and can never return back to Yeshua. The moment that they willingly take that mark, they have married themselves, they have fornicated with, they have committed spiritual adultery, idolatry with Hasatan, they have sealed their fate eternally. You see, this is the danger that Christians don't understand when they refuse to understand the Torah, when they refuse to obey the Torah. There are a lot of things that they miss, and this one is a biggie. So with that and the concluding exhortation for us to remember to block out the name of Amalek from under heaven, I'm going to say Shabbat Shalom.